making contact with an anti-Soviet officer of the Outer Mongolian Army. To prevent such activities, the Outer Mongolian Army had guard units making constant rounds and had declared the entire band of territory 10 to 20 kilometers in from the Manchukuo border to be off limits. But this was a huge area to patrol, and they could not keep a watch on every bit of it. Even if their rebellion should succeed, it was obvious that the Soviet army would intervene at once to crush their counter-revolutionary activity, and if that happened, the insurgents would request the help of the Japanese army, which would then give Japan's Kwantung army an excuse to intervene. Taking Outer Mongolia would amount to sticking a knife in the guts of the Soviets' development of Siberia. Imperial headquarters back in Tokyo might be trying to put the brakes on, but this was not an opportunity that the ambitious Kwantung Army General Staff was about to let slip from their fingers. The result would be no mere border dispute, but a full-scale war between the Soviet Union and Japan. If such a war broke out on the Manchurian-Soviet border, Hitler might respond by invading Poland or Czechoslovakia. This was the situation that Sergeant Hamano had been referring to in his remark on the potential for war. The sun rose the next morning, and still Yamamoto had not returned. I was the last one to stand sentry. I borrowed Sergeant Hamano's rifle, sat on a somewhat higher sand dune, and watched the eastern sky. Dawn in Mongolia was an amazing thing. In one instant the horizon became a faint line suspended in the darkness, and then the line was drawn upward, higher and higher. It was as if a giant hand had stretched down from the sky and slowly lifted the curtain of night from the face of the earth. It was a magnificent sight, far greater in scale, as I said earlier, than anything that I, with my limited human faculties, could comprehend. As I sat and watched, the feeling overtook me that my very life was slowly dwindling into nothingness. There was no trace here of anything as insignificant as human undertakings. This same event had been occurring hundreds of millions, hundreds of billions of times, from an age long before there had been anything resembling life on Earth. Forgetting that I was there to stand guard, I watched the dawning of the day, entranced. After the sun appeared above the horizon, I lit a cigarette, took a sip of water from my canteen, and urinated. Then I thought about Japan. I pictured my hometown in early May, the fragrance of the flowers, the babbling of the river, the clouds in the sky, friends from long ago, family, the chewy sweetness of a warm rice puff wrapped in oak leaf. I'm not that fond of sweets as a rule, but I can still remember how badly I wanted a mochi puff that morning. I would have given half a year's pay for one just then. And when I thought about Japan, I began to feel as if I had been abandoned at the edge of the world. Why did we have to risk our lives to fight for this barren piece of earth, devoid of military or industrial value? This vast land where nothing lived but wispy grass and biting insects. To protect my homeland, I too would fight and die. But it made no sense at all to sacrifice my one and only life for the sake of this desolate patch of soil from which no shaft of grain would ever spring. Yamamoto came back at dawn the following day. I stood final watch that morning, too. With the river at my back, I was staring towards the west when I heard what sounded like a horse's whinny behind me. I spun around, but saw nothing. I stared towards where I had heard the sound, gun at the ready. I swallowed, and the sound from my own throat was loud enough to frighten.